community. And I had intended to begin with poetry by Linda McCarriston, a collection called Eva Mary, to which I will return in a minute, but I think I'm going to change the introduction of this session. And change it in two steps. I'd ask you to think yourselves, and write if you'd like for just a couple of minutes, but it's terrible to say just a couple of minutes, but I'll say it. Think, feel, write about the following. Are there in your own families experiences of violence and connections with sexuality? Are there in your own families, whether your present family or family of origin, grandparents, etc., experiences of violence and connections of violence and sexuality? And I want to begin talking about that while you're still writing, if you are, or thinking. In a lot of families, there's a lot of violence that nobody ever talks about. And when I was growing up in North and South Dakota, my father is a retired UCC minister, and we would drive to see the grandparents in Wishick, North Dakota, or Turtle Lake, North Dakota, fairly regularly, very family visiting kind of family. And visit aunts and uncles, all 10, 16, all 32 of them. First cousins, all 73 first cousins I have. So that's that kind of North Dakota farm family. And when my father's parents retired, they retired into Wishick from the farm. My grandfather, my paternal grandfather, had run for Congress in North Dakota back in the 20s. And toured the state and was finally elected to the legislature, which I didn't know until I had left home. And I only found out 3 years ago that it was during that campaigning that he became alcoholic. He had never consumed alcohol in any serious sense until he started campaigning with this other guy, and they toured North Dakota. And he began to drink on the road, on the campaign. And I remember visiting when they retired, visiting in their home in Wishick, and I always felt uneasy, never knew why. There was always a tension in the air about those visits, even though the visits were also full of Grandma's gloxinias, which were spectacular, and her homemade cabbage soup, which was spectacular. But there was something in the air in my parents' interaction as we approached Wishick, which I didn't understand at the time. It's only in the past 3 years that I have learned from my mother, and now my father too, he'll talk about it, that my grandmother often had to hide in the closet at night because my grandfather would come home from the bar, having had nothing much to do in retirement in town in Little Wishick, and he would be very violent and beat her when he got home. These alcoholic rages. And my grandmother was an immigrant from Russia, barely literate in English, a very pious woman, but she absolutely did not complain about it. She had not been taught to complain about it. She had been taught to accept it, and taught to accept it as part of her Christian faith. I now can understand the atmosphere of that home, because violence was always just over the edge. Nobody wanted to cross my grandfather because nobody knew when he would move into that violence. My grandfather was a wonderful man, absolutely wonderful man. He worked hard all his life. He fed thousands of people with that farm. But he also was a man who had learned that to be the father and husband in the family was to be the patriarch. and alcohol intensified his theology and enabled him to act on it when there was still part of him that knew that beating his wife was against what he had learned in religion, because he got both messages from the church. And I think that it's hard for us to talk about violence in our families, because we have the mythology that our families are supposed to be perfect. And to talk about it in public is as hard as talking about sexuality has been in public. I find every now and again in myself a tendency to think maybe a little violence would solve this. Working in the church, some of the guys were utterly horrible misogynists. Clerical collars they had, but they were misogynist. And I thought, oh, what a belt in the mouth would do for their misogyny. The solution of violence in this culture is ready at hand. And a lot of it is learned in the home. By the way, I forgot that I hadn't mentioned, for those of you who have never encountered me with this, this is menopause that causes me to use this, by the way. I learned at dinner that I forgot to say it. But it's hot flashes. And sometimes hot flashes are triggered by the M&Ms that I bought in the bookstore today and ate this afternoon. Chocolate does it. But sometimes hot flashes are triggered by stress, tension. And I know that sitting in front of a group and talking about my grandfather beating my grandmother has triggered a hot flash in my body, reacting to the realization that it's very difficult to draw the line between male and female. It's also very difficult to draw the line between good and evil. And who can sit here among us? But I don't want to leave that as the only introduction to this topic. I do want to add to it two other themes. And this collection of poetry is part of an emerging body of literature which deals with the question of so-called domestic violence, violence in the context of intimacy and love. And it's a collection of poetry written by a woman who grew up outside of Boston in Lynn. It was nominated for the National Book Award in Poetry a couple of years ago. I want to read only one poem, but I urge the volume on you, as it's a powerful collection of poems. But there's also, I want to mention in this connection, a novel that's currently popular called A Bastard Out of Carolina. You may have heard reviews of it. It's a novel by Dorothy Allison. She writes almost as well as what we heard this evening in Vespers, but not quite. But she has the same gift for creating in the air totally clear pictures of reality. And her book starts out with a discussion of, and it's autobiographical, she said in interviews, what it feels like to be a victim of incest at the age of 6. We don't often get occasions to read this literature because it hasn't been written yet, but now it's coming out. And I think we're blessed to live at a time when there are people with writing gifts to talk about it. This poem is to Judge Faolian, Dead Long Enough, a Summons. Your Honor, when my mother stood before you with her routine domestic plea, after weeks of waiting for speech to return to her body, with her homemade 40s hairdo, her face purple still under pancake, her jaw off just a little, her holy of holies healing, her breasts wrung, her heart the bursting heart of someone snagged among rocks deep in a shark pool, no, not someone, but a woman there, snagged with her babies, by them, in one of hope's pedestrian brutal turns. When in the tones of parlors overlooking the harbor, you admonished that for the sake of the family, the wife must take the husband back to her bed. What you willed not to see before you was a woman risen clean to the surface, a woman who, with one arm flailing, held up with the other her actual burdens of flesh. When you clamped to her leg the chain of justice, you ferried us back down to the law, the black ice eye, the maw, the mako that circles the kitchen table nightly. What did you make of the words she told you, not to have heard her, not to have seen her there? Almost forgivable ignorance, you were not the fist, the boot, or the blade, but the jaded corrective ear and eye at the limits of her world. Now I will you to see her as she was, to ride your own words back into light. I call your spirit home again, divesting you of robe and bench, the fine white hand and half-lit Irish eye. Tonight, put on a body in the trailer down the road, where your father, when he can't get it up, makes love to your mother with a rifle. Let your name be Eva Mary. Let your hour of birth be dawn. Let your life be long and common, and your flesh endure. The collection of poetry goes on to discuss how her Roman Catholic tradition reinforced the patriarchal violence in the family, which was expressed both in wife abuse and in the abuse of the daughter. And there is a third resource in connection with the religious dimension to which I want to draw your attention. There's a new study out called the Janus Report on Sexual Behavior. And it's a study of sexual behavior in the United States. If you like to read statistics, this is the book. If you want to know how normal your sex life is, this is the book. If normal means majority rule. It is a fascinating study by a couple, both named Janus, and they named the report after themselves. But I was totally taken aback. Sometimes I fall into sort of terminal naivete, which is sort of refreshing since I'm also a cynic. But my naivete hit me again on page 245 of this book. This is not a book for the faint of stomach at all, because it's a very blunt study of sexual behavior, including what many people would call deviant sexual behavior, I suppose. But they run through the book an analysis of practices, including sadomasochism. And I want to read this paragraph because it connects religion and sexuality. Overwhelmingly, our respondents disagreed that pain and pleasure go together in sex. Overwhelmingly is 3/4 of people disagreed. I'm going to stop a second and ask you not to speak about it, but in the deepest heart of hearts, ask yourself how you... Oh, their question was, pain and pleasure really go together in sex? And strongly agree all the way to strongly disagree. Just honestly answer it yourself. And then they give their results. Overwhelmingly, our respondents disagreed that pain and pleasure go together in sex. However, among the minority who agreed with the statement, there was a positive connection with religiosity. 20% of the very religious agreed, and percentages went down to 10% of the not religious. 81% of the not religious disagreed that pain and pleasure went together, compared to only 70% of the very religious who disagreed that pain and pleasure went together. And then they try to figure out what's going on here. Were the very religious invoking the biblical judgment that women shall bear children in pain, Or did they believe that the more religious a woman is, the more she must submit to her husband's advances, painful though her submission may be? In interviews, our respondents described two types of pain, physical and psychological. However, some of them reported the need to couple pain with sex in order to be sexually satisfied. Our observations were that the number of those who subliminally sought pain in sex was higher than those who overtly practiced sadomasochism. And then they go on to say that for some, they function sexually, but the need for pain evinced here may be indicative of a great deal of ambivalence. In order to address this inner dilemma, they associate pleasure with pain and sex with punishment, telling themselves they must feel bad about feeling good. They must feel bad about feeling good. My question to us is, to what degree has Christian teaching about sexuality reinforced that idea? That there's something deeply suspect about being embodied and about being sexual. And almost everybody can experience pleasure in sexual intercourse and sexual activity, giving rise to incredible ambivalence. At the same time, the church has taught that suffering is salvific, and that Jesus' suffering is salvific, and that imitating Jesus is the way to be a good disciple. So we have built in here a close connection between sexuality and pain and suffering. And one of the primary ways to accomplish pain and suffering in our society is through violence. I think that we have to take this one step further and ask one of the most difficult theological questions that there is to ask in the area of sexuality, and that includes family life. I'm going to preface that last most difficult with a strange tension that is present in the Janus Report. I think that they write this report strongly supporting heterosexual monogamy and family life. That was their bias going into it. But they do find a strong and growing interest in going back to family life across all demographic groups in this study. Toward the end of the book, in the last summary section, they celebrate this and say that in a time of great turmoil and confusion due to sexually transmitted diseases, to AIDS, etc., it is not surprising that people want to go back to the safety of home. To the safety of home. And so having a family has become a very strong value, like way, way up, 80 to 90% want that. At the same time, they've pointed out repeatedly in this book that the abuse of children and the battering of women in the home is way higher than the vast majority of people think in this society. So even they have gotten caught up between their hopes and reality. The hope for family as the safe haven of stability in this sea of chaos in society. But they forgot that this very place that they're calling the safe haven is for women and children in the United States the most dangerous place to be. For women and children, there is no more risky place to hang out than at home. That's where the majority of the violence takes place against women and children in the United States. That by way of preface to this final theological question. Is there in our theology a sanctioning of intergenerational violence at the very core of our teaching, which makes it easier for parents to abuse children in the home, for dominant male power to abuse subordinate female power, to use 1 Timothy theologies of marriage? I think we have to ask ourselves, to say it bluntly, whether the sacrifice of the Son by the Father is the kind of theology that is likely to reduce, increase, or ratify child abuse. I'm asking the sacrifice of God the Father, of his only begotten Son. What, think of yourself as a little girl sitting in the church, and she has just been raped by her father the night before, and now she sits and listens to a sermon in which the heart of the gospel is that a father sends his son to crucifixion. That's as big a theological issue in sexual ethics as I know. How can we ask the integrity of our ethics and our theology from the perspective of the most violated? As a feminist, my methodology says you judge the truth of a theology by those who are in the weakest position. What is the effect of the theology on those who are without power, who can't defend themselves over against the dominance? And the value of the theology is judged by them, not by the systematics professor in the seminary. Because the systematics professor in the seminary is more likely to be abusing the child than the child is to be abusing anybody. Except, of course, that now we've got increasing horizontal child abuse, that is, children abusing children sexually. And it's no great surprise because they're learning it from their parents. If we were to move, as we are now for the rest of these sessions, into people-friendly sexual ethics, I would put at the top of my list of new rules for people-friendly sexual ethics a rule which says that you can never, ever, ever abuse children. And if we had only that rule, we would dramatically change the behavior of people sexually for all subsequent generations. 70%+ of all prostitutes in the United States were abused as children sexually. And the number of Minnesota teenagers who have been lured from St. Paul and Minneapolis and Rochester and Winnetka, Minnesota, to the streets of New York is in the tens of thousands, who have become prostitutes by virtue literally of kidnapping. The readiness of children to go along with an invitation to New York is in direct proportion to their abuse at home. Remember the milk cartons that said so-and-so is the children who are missing, and to try to track them down all across the country? They never said at the bottom of the milk carton, most of these children have run away from home because they're running away from incest and other abuse. What was the image? Some big stranger who kidnaps them off the street. And we warn children, don't talk to strangers. We should be warning children, don't talk to your father. Don't talk to your mother. Because that is the greater danger than the danger of abuse from strangers. This is terribly difficult material because it doesn't fit our mythology of family. When I hear Jerry Falwell and others talk about family values and a return to family values in the United States, I always want to remind that one of the biggest family values is hierarchical violence. There is another book called Spare the Child, and it is a study of evangelical theology in the United States and the connections with the disciplining of children. And Philip Greven, in this book, Spare the Child, argues that even though most families don't use the most severe forms of physical disciplining of children, like keeping them in basement rooms for weeks on end, as has happened to one of my happened to one of my friends in her youth. And it was all justified by a certain kind of Baptist theology. Nonetheless, Grieven says, most middle-class liberal families in the United States will still defend spanking. And he traces this as a form of child abuse that has been repeatedly legitimated theologically. I think that we have a problem on our hands to talk in church about a pattern of behavior which we have defended theologically for centuries. And the question becomes, how do we make a major shift theologically so that we can break the pattern of, to use the Hebrew scriptural image, the children grinding their teeth from generation to generation? We have a little less than half an hour left. I solicit your response, your assistance now, in how to proceed with this conversation. I'm going to stop talking at this point, and I want to know if you want to stay in plenary conversation or move to small groups or something else. Do you have any preference? Even though it's difficult, if you could discuss your own experiences of sexuality and violence, and if you haven't had them, whether you know people who have, and the theological question. The theological question is, do we understand the relationship of God to humans, including God to Jesus, in such a way that it legitimates a ladder of violence? There's a Lutheran in Texas named Salutary Repression. Larry, it'll come to me in a second. It's a charismatic Lutheran, and he does a teaching on family marriage and family, in which he shows God as a very large hand, very clearly male hand. God is holding a hammer in his hand, and the hammer is the husband. And the hammer hits the anvil, and the anvil is the wife. And the children are the raw diamonds that are supposed to be cut into the perfect shape. And that image of power descending from male to male, and then to the woman, and then to the children at the bottom, is an image of power which creates, serious is an understatement, problems in sexuality that are rampant in this culture. So I'd like you to talk about that, if you're willing.
I'd like to say one thing about the church. I don't get the connection as to how you can justify child abuse from church theology. But also...
Let's check. I want to check something, though. Do you want to pursue this in plenary discussion, in the whole group or in small group?
Big group.
Big group? Any... Okay, hearing no dissent. I don't want to shut anybody out who wants to say small. Okay, go ahead then. We'll continue.
Yeah, and in the Lutheran church now, there is that attitude of patriarchal dominance, at least not in our church. And also, even if the church takes a stand and talks about child abuse and things, which we have, and we have workshops and different things, the thing is that a lot of these people that this is going in these families, and you have to remember a family now could be one person, a mother with children, there may not even be a father present. Most of these families aren't in church.
That will not wash.
Okay, let's say it this way then. The majority of the people don't attend church, the way I understand it, at least on the Northwest. Most of them are unchurched. So they're not in church. I'm not saying there aren't people in church that maybe don't have these problems in their family, but a lot of people don't go to church, so to lay the whole burden on the church is kind of unrealistic.
I'm not laying the whole burden on the church.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm going to make that.
But I am laying a burden on the church.
Yeah, and that's a legitimate concern. That's
what do you make?
For the people that are in church.
Yeah. I'd love to visit your congregation. If there's a non-patriarchal Lutheran congregation, I'd love to see it.
Well, it's not an emphasis. Yeah, you should. Maybe you should.
Do you, in that congregation, do you use the Green Book?
Yeah.
Well, then I'm sorry. I don't believe your claim. Because the Green Book, which I know all too well, as a Lutheran, the theology of Sunday morning worship is a theology of God the Father, who is King and Lord, who has absolute power.
No, I didn't say we were perfect. I said that. I said our emphasis is getting away from that, and the
Good.
Church is changing, and it
Great.
Takes time. You don't go in there and drive it down there. Going to evolve, you know, that's the worst thing. But it's, I feel good about it.
Well, I want to celebrate that. If your congregation is dealing regularly with child abuse, with wife battering, with the murder of spouses, I think that's terrific.
And also in cooperation with the Ministerial Association in Cashmere. We work with
Great.
The church.
Great.
And the school.
Write it up in the Lutheran.
And I think this is good on other communities. Yeah. I mean, I don't think it's as dismal as...
Well, let's see. We all have experience. We can find out.
Well, I don't really know where I'm going to go with this. But this last couple of years, my mom and her sisters and brother found out that my grandfather used at least a couple of them when they're very young. My aunt, when she was probably 7, and sexually raped her. And my grandfather, and you know, a very public figure, very poetic man, very verbal, in some ways a big figure that he was kind of mythical. He was a big man physically. And in the words he spoke, he could quote poetry off the top of his head. He did so. And my aunts and uncles are, and my mother too. My mother was the oldest, and she doesn't really know if she was abused. But my aunts and uncles are suffering from that right now, and so are their families. And I don't know how this affected me, but it's disturbing, I guess, because of how I grew up seeing my grandfather. I knew my grandfather was angry some of the time, but he was also a pretty attractive person. And so a lot of what it means to me is it makes things confusing that he was also violent and hurt my family. And I grew up in the Methodist Church. And in Washington, the Methodist Church is pretty liberal. A lot of the churches have a lot of teachings about it. We had a class where we talked about sexuality, you know, in Sunday school. But somehow, I grew up as a kid and being ashamed of myself. Being ashamed of masturbation and thinking I was a bad person because of that. And I think in some ways the fact that the figure in my faith that I look up to is one that suffered, that enabled me to suffer. I just had a lot of shame and carried that with me. I still carry it with me. And I think shame and fear is a bigger reason for me not having had sex yet, and any big moral decision. Actually, I know that it is. And it wasn't until my junior year of college when I was pretty much emotionally just broken that I really had to deal with how I looked at myself. Because before, my images of myself were, you know, from the church. I was a leader in church groups and in high school and when I was younger, and I was a good student and a good athlete. And so I should have had a good self-image according to kind of traditional views of successful and what it is to be successful. But my junior year, I found out that in a lot of ways I hated myself. And it's strange because what got me through that was my faith, but part of what caused it was my faith. And I found out that the biggest thing, the reason I hated myself was because I was afraid of hurting people. And somehow I connected that with sexuality. And maybe that's because somehow I knew that my grandfather was violent. I don't know, because I didn't know at that time. But I think that we do hide a lot of things. And I think that, well, for me, my faith will save me, and it's kind of brought me through, but I just know that we don't try to hurt people by teaching them what we teach them, but somehow I learned to hate myself, and I think that that happens in a lot of people, man and woman, for different reasons. And maybe sometimes men abuse people because they're not happy with themselves. I don't know.
I think it must be a mark of the power of grace to that you have done what you've just done. If anything lately has given me hope about a change in the church in this regard, it is your courage in speaking as you've just spoken. I find it just immensely moving. Because you, to break the silence for white men in this culture on issues of sexuality and violence, it takes a whole lot of courage and grace. And I thank you for that. Because the signs of hope aren't exactly flowing down like the streams of justice yet. So may your tribe increase. I can tell by body language in the room that you spoke others' truth in many cases.
You know, I was raised Catholic, and it was always taught that, you know, sex wasn't discussed, and God forbid that you should enjoy it, really. And I hope somebody tells you somewhere along the line that it's okay to masturbate.
I've learned that.
Get it out.
That's one, in fact, in the Janus Report, it's one of the most dramatic changes in sexual behavior in the United States. And they attribute it to, that is, the overwhelming acceptance of masturbation for adults. And all the way up into their 80s and 90s, it's a significant change in the understanding of aging and sexuality, too. But they attribute that change to the insistence by women in the early part of the women's movement that the insistence by women on our own sexual pleasure. And once women started discovering masturbation, that all of a sudden the whole thing just shifted, and it's hardly even a question for anybody anymore. That doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of people who still have trouble with it, but it's just hardly an issue.
Can you imagine the guilt that men and women go through, you know, through their teen years when your hormones are going rampant and it's just sort of a thing that you, like, experience, and then you're told that by God that this isn't acceptable? And that's a tough pill to carry around.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How many in this room never had that problem at all?
Nobody ever told me that was wrong.
On just masturbation or sexuality in general?
Hardly anything. I guess I'm unusual. I don't remember my father like ever spanking me except once.
Did your mother?
A few times, but I feel like I hear a lot of these stories that I didn't realize my home was different, but I guess I was pretty blessed. I mean, we weren't a perfect family either, but I had a really kind, gentle father. I guess I should be fortunate.
There's a problem that I've experienced in the consistency, I guess, with the image. Like, I know in Central America, for instance, there the people that control Nicaragua and so forth, the 14 families in El Salvador, that, you know, most of them were Catholic, and they would be able to, you know, murder people during the week and then go to communion on Sunday. And there's a tremendous inaccuracy or the inconsistency of what they were supposed to be. And maybe it has something to do with their image of God Almighty and God the Warrior in some way, but I don't know if it's that makes them so cool and so detached from killing bodies, killing people, and then going to church and receiving the body of Christ. I just don't know, but I know there's this really inconsistency there. It's laughable, it's scandalous, you know. But whether it's coming from that, their image of God the Father, as opposed to God the Mother, I don't know. If God was a mother to them, could they do the same thing? Or would it have been the same thing?
I think one Old Testament story for me that's always been incomprehensible is the test of Abraham's obedience, by building an altar to sacrifice his son on. And I guess I've never been able to make any sense of that. That somehow God would, see our loyalty or whatever, that would cost the life of a child. I've always thought that it was bizarre.
The rabbinic tradition of interpretation there has struggled with that text for millennia, literally, trying to figure it out. I have less trouble with that, since Yahweh does not require the death of Isaac. But the whole point is that Isaac is not sacrificed.
Right.
I have less trouble with that than I do with John 3:16.
Yeah.
For God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son.
Right.
In one sense, this is, well, how wonderful, that's great love to give one son. But that's hearing it from the perspective of one who wasn't abused by her parents. And I think we have to hear the text from the perspective of those who have been and ask how it sounds. And changing to God the Mother won't necessarily help. There's a lot of abuse of children by mothers in this culture. So it's not simply a father problem, it's the problem of inordinate adult power in relationship to children who don't really count.
I have a response. I really don't want to move away from the
personal location of our discussion at all, but I mean, it's painfully probing me, this whole, we're not, Christianity is not the only religion suffering from this, obviously. Not only that, it's not the only tradition in terms of the world is concerned. We look at mythology and Hinduism and the violence, the male patriarchal violence that's blatant and also blatant in their culture today, particularly against women and children, and infanticide and bride burning and this sort of thing. The Islamic culture suffers from a number of problems evident in relation to sexuality, with circumcision of the clitoris to remove pleasure from the possibility and possibility of pleasure in sex, along with other abuses against women. Greek mythology is riddled with these images, obviously, long before Christ came around, or Old Testament. To struggle with, you know, I mean, it's a very large problem, very complicated in how these influences make their way into the construction, or in the man-made construction, I mean that gender specifically, the man-made construction of religion, and particularly Christianity in this case. We look at those influences there, and try to look at that they infiltrate our whole educational system as well. I mean, not necessarily the structure of how it happens, but in the moral of the stories, in the character in which the virtues of the Greek warrior comes out. It's huge, and it's, we're talking about within our religion, but I think keep reaching out and finding out the other areas, the pervasiveness of it. Because of abuse in this fashion, just looked at in terms of our own church, may not be adequate for our families to survive, to come out of the darkness of these troubles and being blinded by them.
Where do we start?
We're here.
We have to try to influence our own church too.
I think if it's not clear where to start, even I'm appreciative that naming the problem as literally global is an important thing to do. It is not simply Christianity and not simply Judaism. The problem of patriarchal dominance is literally global, with some major exceptions. And there are some Native American traditions where this was not that kind of a serious problem, but we can name the exceptions much more quickly. I'm not going to pursue what I was going to pursue. Are there other, excuse me, I decided against that. Go ahead, Netter.
I was just going to say two things about your question about does our theology somehow legitimate the violence. Boy, and I'm not sure. I just know that image of God sacrificing Jesus, to me, is horrible. And I, as a child, was sexually and physically abused, and have been struggling for the last couple of years trying to figure out where my faith fits into it, because religion was not helpful to me at all. And I guess I've been here for 2.5 years, and for probably over a year, every time I would take, we would have the Eucharist service, I just felt I could not participate and would just cry. And it wasn't until last summer, there was a man here, his name was Marcus Borg, who talked about communion, instead of thinking of the body and blood of Christ, which I just, that image is just not helpful for me at all. He talked about it as being food and drink for our faith journey, which has been a much more helpful image for me to think of, and I can sit at a Eucharist now without crying. The other thing, I guess, maybe is a theological question that I've, again, been sort of struggling with, is the whole image of God being this all-powerful, all-knowing being, to me, is, again, a horrible image, because if God is all-powerful, and that's steeped, our liturgy is steeped with that image, then where was God when, as a child, I was being abused? You know, it's one thing, you know, I'm an adult now, and I, you know, have worked through some stuff and feel in control of my life, but as a child, you know, where was God? And I think of the children today who are being abused. Where is God for them? And it's very harmful still to hear about God being all-powerful, and the king, and these images are not helpful at all. And when I have talked to people, theologians, or, you know, these people at Harvard and wherever, who, you know, seem to me, seem to dictate what some of our theology is, they are not interested. You brought up this idea of our theology should take into account the experiences of these people, but most theologians and pastors and bishops are not at all interested in that. And, you know, I think people who have been abused leave the church in great numbers because they are not taken into account.
And now we're finding out that many of those theologians and bishops and pastors are the perpetrators of the abuse in disproportionate numbers. I'm just doing a sequence here. Go ahead, Marie, and then Drew.
Well, I want to respond to your question, where do we start? Because
I think I know. We have to start with ourselves and look beyond.
Well, and I feel like, for me, it's been helpful for people to talk about it. And for, like, also responding to your comment about your church. I grew up in a small town in Illinois, and our church is all related, basically, the one I grew up in. And as far as anybody would ever know, looking at it, nothing happens, and we're the perfect church, and we're all happy, and everybody gets along, etc. But within my own family, I think everybody looks at my family as the perfect family, and mom and dad are still together, and all the kids turned out great, and all of this. But I am an incest survivor, not of my father, but of my brother. And that's not out in my congregation. And I don't know how they would handle that if that were out. But I'm sure I'm not the only one in my congregation. And I think if people would talk about that more and to come out about that more, kind of, I think we would realize how huge it is.
Well, I didn't say our church was perfect. We know we're not perfect.
Yeah.
And my family wasn't perfect, but I did have money.
Mm-hmm.
I think some more to the issue of who's perpetrating or practicing the sexual violence and where it happens. What I say is not meant to generalize or pick on Lutherans. I grew up Catholic, and we all know there's enough trouble going on with the Catholic Church. But back in Minnesota, I have known three Lutheran pastors, three Lutheran youth pastors who abused children in their congregations and in their youth. One of them, sexually abused little boys, another one raped three sisters, one of whom is a very dear friend of mine, another one raped kids in his youth group. Two of these pastors were found out, but because of people's fear to confront, and because of whatever reason, and probably because they were damn good youth pastors, they were allowed to continue practicing their youth ministry and their sexual abuse on these children. One of them was shuffled away to another city in Iowa where people wouldn't know that that would happen to them until the FBI tailed them and caught them. The third one, when he was found out, he wasn't going to get away, and he committed suicide. A dear friend of mine, 2 years after high school, and she was the model person. She was the model girl, the model woman, the model student, the model Christian. She had everything going for her. She had been abused by one of these pastors. She had been abused by her father. She committed suicide. And so I want to say, I don't care if you go to the most wonderful church in the world. There can be some pretty creepy shit going on, and you have no idea. We just have no idea. I think the whole danger of religion and dualism is that we think that because we try to identify with this wonderful person, Jesus Christ, that these things don't happen in our own midst. And I think the whole point of the message of Jesus is that they do happen in our own midst, and we better deal with them.
Go ahead, sir. And then.
Well, I was just going to say that I come from Canada, and I happen to have a personal acquaintance with several of the Lutheran bishops, and I have been advised by them that 40% of the clergy is involved in this situation.
It is hard to believe, but it certainly is.
Well, I know that they have a law now that when you hire youth directors or anything to the Lutheran church, that they do have to be checked out. So I know that this has been happening.
It's not just youth pastors.
No, everybody that they're hiring. So I mean, it's very evident that this is a concern.
For many people, power is an aphrodisiac. And we haven't begun to talk about that with regard to the power of clergy in the church.
The stats I've read as far as the prevalence is one out of three girls by the age of 13 are sexually abused, and with boys, if they were starting out saying one out of eight, and as recordings increase, and they're saying one out of six. And how, if we have violence against children as being that prevalent within our society, how do you stop that? Because many of the perpetrators of violence were also abused themselves.
How
do we heal as individuals and as a society?
What really chills me is that there's the cover-up, like you talk about with clergy, but then there's the self-imposed cover-up when children don't remember it consciously, but subconsciously it sits staring into the next generation, and they don't know what's going on either, but it's still there. Mm-hmm. Hidden like that. That probably scares me. Well, both kinds of cover-ups scare me, I guess.
What?
John, are you responding to what?
Actually, no. Secondly.
Hmm?
I just wanted to throw out another stat that surprised me, is that the common ages for girls to be raped are preschool, 3 and 4, and then they kind of skip a few years and then 7 or 8. We're not talking about teenagers anymore.
The thing that bothers me is I think they must have told somebody or somebody must know, and nobody did anything. I mean, in each case, there must be, I could be wrong.
They don't tell.
Because it's shame often, but it's also the threat of additional violence that keeps children quiet. So that if you tell, I will kill you. If you tell, I will kill your mother.
Yeah. If you have that kind of threat for a young child, yeah, I guess.
Yeah. John?
So I was wondering what the statistics you had in the book about violence within the home and how that would relate to the numbers she just gave. Knowing, I guess, responding to Drew's comment, knowing three pastors in Minnesota, it seems that we're setting up pastors to be superhuman if we expect it not to occur within the clergy. You know, with numbers like 1 in 6 children, it's not surprising then that it happens within the church as well.
And I think we have to ask the question about, I'm reluctant to say it, but the motivations for going into the ordained ministry are often to help people. Mm-hmm. And I have a good friend of mine who, if anybody ever fell into worrying too much about helping other people, it's she. She has almost no apprehension of her own self-interest. She is constantly worried about the effect of her behavior on other people. She happens to be an ordained minister as well. And she's a victim of serious incest. I mean, serious in the sense of extended, long-term. But I found teaching in seminary just a stunning number of the students had been victimized as children sexually. I don't know if it's disproportionate to the society as a whole, because the statistics are, you read various statistics. But I think there's a tendency for people who have been abused to be so self-effacing and to think that it's necessary to take care of the whole universe to try to keep the violence under control, that I wouldn't be surprised if there weren't a disproportionate number of people in helping professions who had suffered abuse themselves. And I know that's a controversial statement, because there are studies that say one side or the other. And it may be that 40% of all people abuse, not just 40% of clergy. But I want to add something there. I think that we, as ethicists, have to make distinctions about moral obligation in relationship to one's power. And I think that responsibility increases directly proportionate to one's power. And in a congregation, that responsibility on the clergy might be unfair in some sense of a pedestal problem. But on the other hand, there is more power there.
And more responsibility.
And more responsibility, therefore.
I think what you were saying before, and I kind of filled the gap in my head here, that the dynamic in which this male dominated patriarchal Christianity creates structures within our church systems of authority that become values and beliefs and ways of life for us to look up to authority, that when it comes to questioning it, we feel helpless. We feel powerless. And to speak against it, we feel little. And if you do speak against it, the whole operation of shame to keep you little keeps you in your place. It doesn't allow you to uncover the improprieties that exist within the church or within the home or within the school. Business.
Yes, you see theologically adults acting like children in response to theological authority or pastoral authority. And Rosemary Ruther has said, I think she has a very good point to make, that as long as we use parental images for God, we will not be able to move away from that. That the believer stays the dependent child in relationship to God, the father or mother. And if you have this structural problem of violence being so quick at hand for the expression of parental authority, will never really break out of this. And the dualism then extends to the question of cooperative power again. As long as God has this absolute power and we have only faithful powerlessness, I just don't think we're going to change it.
I'd like to lump some interesting names together. I think one thing, perhaps, a couple things that Jesus Christ, Mohandas Gandhi, Jim Jones, Martin Luther King, and Dave Koresh all had in common were that hopefully they all meant well at the start, and that they were all beloved by their people. People look to them for answers, for truth. You're talking about abuses of power, and I don't believe that, I've never heard of anyone that could handle a tremendous amount of power, with the possible exception of Jesus Christ, Martin Luther King, and Gandhi. But even King and Gandhi had some pretty outrageous abuses of power toward the end of their life. I don't believe that any person that I've ever heard of can handle that sort of reverence from other people. When you put someone on a pedestal, look to them for nurturance, for healing, and then you do it times 100 or times 1,000 people, that is dumbfounding to me. I can't comprehend that. But I can see where someone steps over the line one day and decides, since all these people are treating me like God, I must be God. And why can't I have sex with every woman in this compound?
Yeah. I couldn't agree more wholeheartedly. I would hope that we can, however, talk about power in a way that doesn't mean that power is only that kind of power.
Obviously there's personal and spiritual power, constructive power.
And cooperative power.
And cooperative power, which I think, you know, if you went to Gandhi and said, what is the truth? Gandhi might say, well, what do you think the truth is? Jesus might do the same thing. What do you think the truth is? At some point, Jim Jones started saying, I know the truth, and I know everything.
Yeah.
And that's where it goes from cooperative, where he built his leadership, to completely destructive.
Well,
I just think that, and I haven't heard mentioned here, and maybe it relates to Doris saying, well, why don't they say something? Because sexual abuse is not always a violent act. Very often for a child, it's a loving act, or at least that's how it's interpreted to them. So, you don't tell. You don't say anything.
It just seems to me that if something like that had been going on in my family, that I would have known about it. I could have pretended I didn't, but I think I would have known.
I think what you raise is very...
You have to take responsibility. And as child abuse, they get back to children. I was going to say something Rich said that about, I think the problem in our society now is just abandonment of our children. And an institution cannot take the place of care for the church, the school, or the government, or whoever of that family or parents, or whoever is the main security for that child.
If the parents, if the main security for the child isn't abusing the child. And I think, you know, if life were so simple, it would be wonderful. But I'm very glad you said what you did, because it reminded me of a dimension of this which hasn't been brought up this evening. And the violence that's always there in child abuse is often perceived only from the perspective of somebody outside.
True, sure. And for the child.
For the child, it can be pleasurable.
Yeah, well, if it's given in that way.
That's,
yeah.
and it's still
and
child abuse.
Know the difference. But for the child, if it's a father or it's a male they think a lot of, and they're comfortable with, you know,
they aren't mature enough. You aren't mature enough to even know. And so you accept what that more mature person gives you as love or gives you as caring for you. And it's not a violent act, only by others that know better. The child.
Betrayal of trust?
Not till later.
That's what makes it so insidious.
You have to grow into that. You know.
It used to mean that children are pretty perceptive. I know they sense things in the family. They can tell when things aren't going well, even if they don't hear their parents arguing. I mean, they know if something's going on.
But a child only has his own point of view. He can't know that other children don't have to go through that.
I'm not saying that children are responsible because they're children for taking care of it. They can't take care of it, but I say that they probably realize that things isn't quite the way things should be.
Mm. If they grow up with it, they might not realize that every other kid doesn't go through the same thing. They might go, so how should a 2-year-old, a 3-year-old know that that's there?
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who, a male friend who's raped. And it was until 2 years of counseling, going to meetings to get through that. But what also came out of it was realizing that he was sexually abused as a child. He never realized that. He came out through the years of counseling. And having to go and confront his family.
And the body doesn't forget. All the experience is still there in the body, even while the mind, being very flexible in human beings, takes all sorts of devices to try to forget the pain, and often successfully does. But many people's physical illnesses are the expression of that abuse, which the body still knows.
It's repressed.
Yes, yes. Or I have 3 friends of mine who are multiple personalities, that was the way they dealt with childhood abuse. And they are all working through to try to come to terms with this, but the self divides and becomes very different persons, a set of different persons to deal with the pain. And there's nothing in the mechanisms of college life, undergraduate or graduate, which says it is all right for you to take 4 months off in this academic year to heal. Our whole society is set up as if people never had these problems. You just move from job to job, from whatever task to whatever task. And where is the structuring so that the incredible pain that is present in our society has place to heal? It's just, we operate as if everybody never was pained.
I just wanted to say, getting back to the thing about where to start and your comment about talking about it, which I think is a wonderful place to start. When you start talking about it, it seems like there are sort of 2 things happening. One is naming the problem, which is the power hierarchy which we have in all of our institutions and culture. Naming the problem, the cultural problem that is
become a problem also of the church. But also, we have to heal. I mean, it's clear that there is so much pain in this fairly small room full of people. You know, times that out, the entire culture is just almost excruciating. Like, you hardly even think about it. And so it seems like part of the theological question is not only how do we restructure our institutions and our myths and our relationship with God so that we eliminate the byproduct of violence and sexuality, but also how do we heal? How do we
It's hard to know what to do. Maybe 8 years ago or so, I was teaching Tuesday school, and I had this one girl alone for a while, and so we were talking about fathers, and of course, I was very fortunate to have a wonderful dad, and I compare him to God, you know, loving father that provided for me, and you know, so we were talking about this one. And she said, she wouldn't believe it. She said, because my dad doesn't love me. And, you know, I was just caught, I just didn't know what to say. Because she was from a split home, and her father lived there, and she lived with her mother. Her dad didn't care whether she was sick or... And so, you know, you don't know how to handle it. Mm-hmm. I felt so bad for her, but I couldn't do it. You know, it was an opportunity for me to try and help her, but I was just prepared.
But you were helping and that you were listening.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sometimes that's the most important help. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
I'm not really sure how I'm going to get to this point, but my mother is an attorney, and she works for the state prosecuting child abusive parents, and has done this for quite a few years, well, since she got out of law school. And I remember all through when she started working there, her vision of people changed, and that the way she looked at people and the way she looked at just people in general changed from very positive outlook to, you know, you never know who anyone is. And not that she feels threatened by everyone, but that she talked to my brother and I about this, and it was part of saying you can't know who everyone is and all this. And since when I was in third grade, my parents were divorced, and I have always lived half the time with my mom and half the time with my dad. So when I was really young, we went every other day, and then every other half a week, and then every other week. And I remember, since my mom was part of this, and this had come up, child abuse had come up quite a few times in different ways, my mom telling stories of cases, different situations at the dinner table, and that, but then I would go to my dad's house, and it was, so my brother and I were still in a single parent family with a father, Ed, which I guess is different than most, the way it is most of the time. And I remember being worried about that and being, well, you know, what if that happens to me? And, you know, there's no one here and it's just my dad, you know? And every night he would come in and say goodnight to us and put us to bed and tell us stories. And this never, ever happened to me. And I was never touched by it physically. But I remember being so afraid when I was young, just because I was told about this. This was part of my mom's life, and I was living in a single-parent, male-headed household. And I remember how afraid I was as a young kid, even though that it never occurred. And my dad is not at all like that. And now I kind of, you know, I can't believe that ever crossed my mind, because it's ludicrous that when you're a little kid and you hear about this, it doesn't matter who it is. It doesn't matter, you know, how great the person is. People still think about it. And so I think there's the opposite that needs to be thought about too, is how many kids know about it and are afraid of it and don't even know it happened to them, but it's still part of a fear factor in their life. Because I remember how absolutely afraid I was sometimes being with just my dad at home just for, you know, a week. But it was never like that in my family.
Yeah, I think that is a very helpful point that reminds us of something we haven't dealt with enough yet, and that is that however healing is going to take place, we can't think of any of this as if we were all separable individuals. That these problems are problems that are problems of interconnectedness. And none of us is really free from this violence, whether or not we have been literally, physically violated. Because it is a social structural issue, it affects all of us. And the solution to it can't be simply individual healing, crucial though that is. But to heal one individual is immediately to start healing the whole interconnected process. But that dilemma, to talk is to bring more fear. Talking about date rape in colleges, all of a sudden, every single date, every single male becomes a potential rapist. And once that dawns on you, then you understand what patriarchy is. The right of men to women's bodies. And that's our dilemma, not simply that one-third or one-fourth are actually victimized in the technical sense. I'm glad that you raised what you just did. Go ahead. Well, I think we'll take one or two comments, and we've got exactly 15 minutes to get to open house, too, although I hate to close this off. Oh, also the balcony, too, so go ahead and we'll...
this brings up a question for me. My son is 4, and how do I discuss this with him to make him aware of, you know, the possibility, I guess, of abuse without scaring him, without, you know, with letting him know what the bounds are?
There's some excellent books for children that don't emphasize the violent side of this as much. They don't start from fear, which is how too much of our education is done about anything sexual, but the books start with the integrity of the child's body and the right of the child to determine who gets to touch that body. And it's for very young children. It starts at the age of 2 and up. And I think that it makes immense sense for children and adults. Who gets to touch your body? And you get to say that. It doesn't matter. And the books are very clear. It says it doesn't matter if it's grandpa or grandma. It doesn't matter. You take all the major, important, intimate people. So I think that those resources are a very helpful place to start for children, to teach children.
Any resources that you can give me? Direct me?
I can send you a list if you give me your name and address, and I'd be happy to do that.
Check with your local elementary school. I know they have some really good
Spokane. The Spokane School District has a publication, a curriculum actually for classrooms.
that's real reasonable.
Where are you located?
Holden Village.
I'll send in a list of resources to the resource center here, and that can be available for everybody. You're next.
Well, I guess I'm kind of afraid to say this, but and I've heard a lot of passionate speech tonight from men, both men and women. But I think that one part of people-friendly sexual ethics is hearing both voices. And I just wanted to point out that I heard a disproportionate number of men speaking in the room as opposed to the number of women. And I don't know why that is, but I think it's very typical in large group settings. And I just wanted to point out.
And I'm glad that you did, because it's a function of not going into small groups. I mean, one consequence of not going into small groups is exactly that. Thanks.
I wanted to say one more thing about, in terms of people wanting to find some healing for this, and one part of that is people telling their stories and talking about it. And I guess I just want people to realize it's very risky for people who've been abused to talk about it. I have not done it in this community until very recently. One of the reasons I haven't done it is I've chosen to privately tell people, and usually choose very well. But it has happened in this community that I did tell one person and had what I thought was a very good reason for telling that person. And then sometime later, when I had a conflict with that person, it came back. Well, you were abused, and this, you are sick, and this is your problem. You know, so that's just something for people to be aware of, that if someone does choose to talk about it, it's not easy. And I guess be very gentle with what you choose to say back to that person.
We have done a lot this evening, and I suspect felt a lot. I was solicit your help. I'm not the best person in God's sweet earth at rituals and closings of things. Does anybody have a sense?